Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. Lo Harris is a New York City-based artist, educator, and children's book illustrator, and she champions vibrance, confidence, and joy. And if you have not seen her art, you need to check it out after this episode. Through the use of bright colors, strong figures, and relational compositions, she creates celebratory work that promotes visions of a more just and kind world. And Lo, you do this so incredibly well. Her work integrates themes of social justice, female empowerment, and mental wellness. And since starting her art career in 2020, she has lent her eye and vision to a roster of clients that is off the charts, including Amazon, Old Navy, Hulu, Warby Parker, Bombay Sapphire, the UN, and so many more. I mean, Lo, you have been swept off to Cannes. You have been on the Ellen show. I mean, there's so many things that you have done. And it's crazy because your career is in a totally different realm than you, of course, set out in your journey. So I just want to take it back a little bit and talk about, you know, first, you're from Alabama.
Yes.
And you did go to a fine arts school in high school, but tell us a little bit about your intention as far as what you thought you were going to do. And you did actually end up doing for a little bit, at least, when you graduated.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Aliza. Very
pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Pleasure.
And to answer your question, so I did go to the Alabama School of Fine Arts for high school. And the arts is something that isn't really a stranger to my family. My mom is a professional harpist. Wow. You know, my dad's just a creative dude. Like, you know, he doesn't have like any particular arts-based skill. He's just having a good time. And my mom chose to put me in that school because, you know, I was like writing short stories about horses, which I've never even ridden a horse. I was not a real horse girl. I do not know why I was writing these short stories about horses. But my mom found these stories I wrote about horses. And she said, oh, this is a perfect opportunity to put her in a school that's going to enable her creative side and also give her an interesting prospect for colleges. And I ended up going to the Alabama School of Fine Arts studying creative writing, which I really enjoyed. I enjoyed drawing, but I always kind of just drew for myself. And I would never take my art seriously because I knew that I had classmates who were actually going to class for art. So any art that I would create was strictly, or visual art that I would create was just strictly just like for fun, like playing around. So I really felt like that label of creative writing student meant, you know, I have to be a writer of some sort. And it was a fantastic program. It was very similar to a lot of like college master's writing schools where you have peer critiques and roundtables and juries and like a student publication. But I was a little bit burnt out by the time I got out. You know, I just could not imagine doing this again, but in college, because it was such an intense experience in high school. So I thought, all right, I have the skill in writing. I really don't know exactly what I want to do. And my mom said, well, what about journalism? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I ended up applying to Northwest University's Medill School of Journalism, and I got in.
Which is major.
Awesome school. And I ended up going to some of my first classes in writing, and they were kind of trying to reteach us how to write, but like it was dry. And I understand why it was dry, because it was writing for news. Like, you know, you're trying to really get the kids to get the facts. I totally get that. But it was a complete shock to me coming from like doing all these vignettes and like all this poetry and like all this experimental formatting. And like we already learned sort of like the more formal traditional formatting of writing, and then to kind of come back and start from square one. But this time it's like no embellishments. You just have to be really straightforward. So that was a huge thing for me. And I decided, oh man, I don't know if I want to do writing as a journalist. I don't want to make money off of my writing. And luckily for me, I ended up taking a multimedia journalism class, which had video editing and video production. And I really was just like, wow, I want to be a video journalist. I want to be working broadcast. I want to like work in digital. Like I want to be behind the camera. I want to be helping to produce stuff. And that's kind of the track that I ended up taking once I started progressing through college and I got more cozy with the idea of like, wow, I'm in college now. I didn't do any of the student publications. Instead, I would kind of do my own thing. So ended up buying like some video equipment of my own, and I would freelance across Chicago, like helping with small marketing agencies, like doing it for abysmally low rates. And I would go and create the student publication on campus for radio because I really liked music and I really liked concerts. And it was a great opportunity to interview musicians. I don't know if you know, Penn Badgley from U has a band. And I interviewed him in an alley. But I didn't know who he was. Like my friend and I kept saying, like, you look like the guy from Gossip Girl. Anyway, can you spell your name? We're student journalists.
Oh, and he was
like P-E-N-N. Like he was like literally spelling his name.
I can't believe you don't know who he was.
And like we asked him, like, so how did it feel opening for this other band? And he was so humble about it. He was just like, it was nice. Like they're a very talented band and we're honored.
Oh my God, Lo, that's hysterical.
So I was just having a good time. Then I got really into motion design because it was like the start of Vox videos. And Vox was that girl, okay, when it came to new media. Vox was that girl. Like they were creating such wonderful graphics and it was my dream to work at Vox. So I decided, oh, I'm going to teach myself After Effects. And I ended up teaching myself some After Effects. We didn't really have classes in college for that, at least available to the journalism students. And I ended up getting an internship at the New York Times, ended up getting an internship at Bustle Media.
Those are some major internships. How did you get those?
Well, the New York Times one was funny. I applied for that, but I really wanted to be a video person. Like I was applying as like a video camera out in the field reporter person. And I had all these clips from just like random packages I edited together. And then one of the last clips I had was like a motion design exercise I did for a previous internship at the Chicago Reporter. And it was like one of my first internships as a journalism student. And they called and they were like, hey, we like this one video at the end you have, and we don't want you for the video editing internship, but we want you for this other thing, motion design. Have you heard of it? And I did not know what motion design was at that time, like really. And I didn't think I was qualified for it. So I was like, oh, yeah. They were like, do you have any more of those videos?
Well, you know, actually, while we're here, what is motion design? Tell people.
Motion design is pretty broad. It's like a part of animation. I wouldn't say that it's like the same as animation that we traditionally think of with characters and children's media and Disney and all of that. But motion design is like a really great intersection between like advertising and animation, you know, just like text motion design, sometimes character motion design. And it's often just categorized in terms of advertising and shorter form media. And it's not necessarily in the same sort of spirit as like animating for film or television. So it's just another form of animation. But at the time I was like, girl, I don't know what you mean, motion design. And so they asked, do you have any more of those? And I was like, yeah. And so I swear I went and I got my uncle to give me just some data stats because he like works with, you know, a healthcare company or whatever. And they had open stats. And I was like, hey, can you just give me some stats that I can turn into data viz graphics?
So like infographics.
Yeah. So he just gave me the stats and then I like,
oh my God.
And then you taught myself how to make a pie chart and all this stuff. And then I like made this thing. Like,
but I love that. I love that because, you know, you can go one of two ways in that scenario. You can freak yourself out and be like, no, I don't have anything else. This is my one example. Or you can completely fake it till you make it and be like, totally got this. And then hustle on the back end to make it happen, which I love.
Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. And then when I sent it, they emailed me back like, oh, we correct this one thing. And I was like, okay. And then I got the job.
That's
so
amazing.
It was like a great first internship for motion design. And I got to like meet a lot of really cool people there. And going back to, where was I? I did Bustle. Bustle was a part of, so Northwestern has this really cool thing for the journalism students called JR, Journalism Residency, where they essentially match students to a publication.
Oh, that's cool.
And when I got to Bustle, it was really interesting because like the person who was supposed to be my advisor at the time, like left by the time I got there, but she was this lady who was kind of trying to put me in my place a little bit and be like, just like trying to gatekeep girl boss or whatever. And I'm just like, all right, you know, and when I was doing the internship, it was a struggle at first because it was a lot of busy work at first. And I think that there was a lot of dissonance between what I was told I was there to do by my program manager at the college and what I was told that I was going to do for them, you know, based on their business needs. And then there was just like a lot of dead air where it was like, okay, I feel like I'm not using my time wisely. So instead of, again, just sitting there and be like, oh, I'm just twiddling my thumbs in my internship, I went to like the head of video and I was like, look, here's what I was told I'd be doing. Here's what I'm actually doing. Here's how much time we have left. Here are my skills. And here are some examples of proof that I can do this. And I know you have this coming up. So can I do that?
Oh my God.
I literally had to just tell them like, this is what needs to happen. And she was like, yes.
That's amazing. Wait, did your direct advisor, your direct supervisor know that you did that?
No, I literally had to just take matters into my own.
Oh my God, you go girl.
And be like, look, like this is silly. Like I have this potential. And it's exhausting trying to like prove yourself constantly, right?
Because
like at this point, I'm like, you know what? I'm out of that phase of my career, but I'm definitely just like, look, if I'm going to do something, I need to make it worth my time. And I need to figure out a way to make it worth my time and strategize how can I get exactly what I need to get to the next step while still obviously fulfilling the duties that I promised to fulfill.
Of course. You did end up getting a job in journalism, though.
Yeah. So basically my entire college life, motion design kept beckoning me and I kept saying no, but I feel like there's something else out there. I didn't go to a portfolio design school. I'm just a lady who knows how to use After Effects. I'm not an actual animator. And so in the midst of this, after college, I ended up taking this rotational program job, the NBC Page program. And the NBC Page program is cool because it's like one of like the oldest media rotational programs out there. And, you know, you wear the suit like Kenneth the Page from 30 Rock and you go around and you like give tours and you deal with a lot of crap. And then you also get this aspect where you get to like work in different departments of NBC Universal. So I got to like work in local news. I got to work in the talent branding in HR. And then finally I got to work at NBC News Now, which is like a off the top or over the top OTT girl, whatever, an app on the TV where you watch the news. I worked there for a while and then I ended up getting a job right after as a associate motion designer at a sister kind of show called Stay Tuned, which is like teeny bopper Gen Z news, you know, on Snapchat. That's where I kind of got to like get really in the depths of motion design. So I worked at that job for about a year and then everything popped off.
I read an interview that you did, and one of the things that you said, which really resonated with me, was when I was in news, I kind of had to reckon with the fact that I didn't even want my boss's job.
I didn't
want to be my boss realistically. So what am I working toward? And I think that is such a great question to ask yourself because, you know, a little bit, we're all on this hamster wheel, right? And you sort of go on this trajectory and then you're like, wait, I don't want to do this.
Mm-mm. No, absolutely. I mean, I actually kind of was having this reflection earlier today because I was thinking about my career and I was thinking about what it took for me to get to this place and the person I was when I was working this job. And, you know, the person who, again, was doing all that hustling and everything, that part of me was great. But then it was a double-edged sword because there was also the part of me that was like, okay, like I'm an eager young journalist who is constantly like one of the first pieces of advice that I was given in school, like from an advisor, was say yes to everything, which I subscribe to like half of that philosophy because I don't believe you have to say yes to everything. But I think we were taught say yes to everything. Like make yourself available, which is like a great thing. But then there has to come a time when you have to like, okay, like I need to make sure that I'm also being fair to myself. Mm-hmm. And so I would do everything to prove to these higher ups that I could like help them, you know what I mean? Meet their metrics with flying colors. And my family always told me, oh, you could be an entrepreneur. And I was like, oh, no, because I need to work in the industry for 10 years and prove myself and pay my dues before I could even think of doing something that was actually reflective of like my potential and my current talents, right? And so for me, when I looked at my boss's job or when I looked at like the higher ups and I looked at their positions, I didn't necessarily see, wow, I want to be them or I want to have their job or I want to live the life that they're living, because like, yeah, they were also stressed out and sometimes they weren't always like the best leaders. But I did kind of feel like there was no other option because it was like I needed to subscribe to meritocracy somewhere in there. Like I was like, how else am I supposed to operate if I'm not being told that I deserve a promotion and being promoted and other people are giving me permission to like move forward? And so during the pandemic, I kind of had this kind of come to Jesus moment where I was like, girl, I've hit the limit of people pleasing. I've hit the limit of trying to prove myself. I've hit the limit of trying to fulfill this role. There's actually this really cool article that came out and it really applies to a lot of like Black women in corporate America as well, called like the pet to threat pipeline, which I thought was really interesting.
The pet to threat pipeline. Okay, so explain that.
So it was this article that basically talks about how when you are a young Black woman in corporate America, and when you're in a subordinate position, like an intern or an entry-level person, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, very non-threatening. Everyone loves you. But then the moment that you start to show competence in your job, in fact, like you accelerate or you excel past the other people and you make your bosses get uncomfortable with that. They get really uncomfortable with that. And then suddenly all of that sort of effort of like, yeah, good job, kid. Which, by the way, I've been called kid by my boss. And I'm like, I am a grown menstruating woman. I ain't no kid. You know, to go from, hey, kid, to, well, you know, you got to learn more. And, you know, really kind of being put in
that is actually
place.
Really, it's very clear to me now what you just said.
Yeah. Okay. So I was a direct, like, I experienced that, like, over the course of quarantine, like, how that entirely shifted. And it was like, oh, I now know that I am threats. So how do I move forward in this
way? That's interesting. So what do you think, in your opinion, I guess, made you become a threat at that point?
I think I was a very eager, hungry. I was like soaking up a lot of information like a sponge. And like I would start taking on like asking for more duties and like trying to do all this stuff. And I do my work like relatively quickly. And I think that it was just like this dissonance of like, I was asking for more work and I was also asking for more pay. And then like, they didn't have the time or the energy to like really provide a clear path forward for me. But instead of taking that and kind of being like, oh, as an organization, we need to do better. It was more so like, oh, you're doing too much. Like, you know what I mean? And you need to tone it down and you need to like slow down. And like, I just felt stuck, you know what I mean? And like, I would see how they would bring in like new men to like occupy positions instead of promoting a lot of the women who are already on the team, you know, just things like that, where it's like, all right.
Yeah. You see the writing on the wall. Totally.
Yeah.
So you broke your hand.
I did break my hand.
Is this like the pivotal moment of the Lo Harris we know today? Like, you had this epiphany, but then obviously something happened where after you broke your hand, you started to illustrate again.
Yeah. So it was interesting. So the hand breaking, I feel like, was like a fun detour. It was like a fun, like, bonus mission. Like, it was like a fun mini game in the way that I got my career. But basically, I saw one of my coworkers with an iPad and I was like, oh my God, if I had this tool, where could my art have gone? Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, oh, this is great. So I purchased the refurbished used iPad. And I was like, this is my moment to really rekindle my inner child. Because I realized how much I love drawing. And I saw the iPad and I thought about all the times that I would be trying to draw on Photoshop and like, you know, Microsoft Paint, you know, with like a mouse pad, you know what I mean? Because I couldn't afford an actual tablet. And I was like, oh, this has got to happen. But when I got the tablet, I realized, oh, I don't know what to draw. Like, have I lost it? I've lost my juice. Because I used to draw every day before college, every single day, learning anatomy, playing with different techniques, different colors, like realism, like more cartoonish things. Like I was having a good time. And when I was in college, of course, I was trying to do school. So I wasn't drawing like that. But when I got my iPad, you know, it was around the time that the pandemic hit and I broke my hand too around Christmas. And I was like, well, dang, you know, and luckily it was the left hand. So I still had my right hand. But since I can't really do anything, I'm like, well, like that's even more time to practice drawing. And I ended up deciding to create this mission for myself to find my style. So I would actively go on Pinterest and I would pin things and I wouldn't pin things and be like, oh, I like this. I'm gonna draw just like that. No, like that's not how you find your own style. I didn't want to make anything that was too derivative, right? I was just like, I want to look at everything and see like what calls to me. What colors am I gravitating towards? What textures am I gravitating towards? Like what styles? Do I like things that are more simplistic or more intense or, you know, more realistic or more abstract and more figurative? Or I just was using that as an opportunity for me to ask a lot of questions and to really develop my style. And I think that one of the things that artists really need is to really think about like what their style is. And I ended up practicing and I created my art Instagram, LoHarris_art, as a way to practice. And I named it Lo because my name is Lauren, but my nickname is Lo. And I named it Lo because I did not want people to find it.
Oh my,
but of course they found it.
That's the best. That's the best part.
And so I ended up, you know, just drawing and like I made up like little challenges for myself, like 29 Queens, where I would draw a different Black woman for Black History Month that year. It was a leap year. And I'd draw. And then I would just do it consistently. And then when stuff started happening with George Floyd, now, mind you, I'm still working in news. So I'm dealing with the coronavirus-like conversations. I'm dealing with the election conversations. I'm dealing with George Floyd and just all of the racial reckoning that happened in 2020. So already as a journalist, that's a lot to deal with. Now, as a Black journalist, specifically on the George Floyd edge, that's like a whole other thing. Because journalism, we're always taught, and like the conversation always goes, we're supposed to be objective. We're supposed to have journalistic objectivity. But the thing is that that concept of objectivity, in my experience, is very rooted in whiteness in a way. Because for me, it's kind of difficult for me as like a minority coming into work who is actively impacted by this thing to not say Black Lives Matter or to not say, you know, this George Floyd thing is crazy because it violates my journalistic objectivity when, you know, they're treating it like it's a political issue, but it's a human rights issue. And so for me, I'm like, what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what do you mean? Yeah. I'm not supposed to say anything. And of course, you know, when other publications started to make it clear that they were going to stand for what's right or whatever, then they were like, oh, yeah, now you can say it. Great. You know, but before the consensus was, well, we don't know if you can do this, which I thought was kind of silly.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I was all pent up inside and really frustrated. And so I took, you know, we have like quote graphics that come in. We have to like make graphics really quick for like a show. And I was available. So I took a graphic. And then when I started making it, I realized that it was the George Floyd death recording. And I had to like, you know, when I work in After Effects, I have to listen over and over to the audio to make sure that the visuals can animate to the audio. And I had to listen to it over and over and over. And so I was like, I'm taking work off. Like I am taking a break. It took a couple of days and ended up drawing this piece called Justice. And I posted it. Actually, I posted it so no one could comment on it because I didn't really want to hear anything that anyone had to say. I didn't expect anyone to even really look at it for real. I just wanted to express myself. And then it blew up. And that blew up. And then a few other pieces blew up. And then all of a sudden I had like Amazon in my DMs. I had Cosmo in my DMs. I had all these people in my DMs. And then suddenly I felt like I was like running because I was like, oh crap. Like, I think I'm starting a business by accident. And I'm a perfectionist. So I'm sitting here like, oh man, I gotta keep this up. I gotta like make sure that I perform in the right way. And like, I'm glad that I kind of had that experience working with producers in news because I knew how to deliver on time. Like I knew how to deliver in quality. Like I wasn't completely brand new and fresh to the production process, which helped. And then I ended up making money. And then it ended up being like more money than I made in my yearly salary. And I was also being treated nicer. And I was like, whoa, that's like, kind of crazy.
That's so amazing. So there's a couple of things. So first of all, I want to just talk about for 1 second, because I do think you're very intentional in your art. But one of the things that I loved is that you have four distinct pillars, right? You've got your visionary, authenticity, community, and education.
Yeah.
And I love this because as a brand person, or when you think about a content strategy, that is how, you know, I would develop a strategy, is think about, okay, what are our content buckets? So one of the things that you said, which I love, is my artwork exists not in ignorance of what's happening in the world, but in spite of what's happening in the world. My work really does want to coexist alongside that chaos. And in a lot of instances, respond to that chaos in a way that tries to turn it on its head. So when you're designing, are you keeping track of like how much of the art is visionary versus education versus community? Like, how do you mentally sort of map what you're doing and also the projects that you take on?
I'm really glad you started talking about the pillars, because the first thing I want to say about my brand pillars is that I love these pillars so much, not because they give me directions on how I should exist and appear as an artist, but they are instructions written for how I naturally am. And so it's really cool because I'm literally like, these are just North Stars for me. This isn't a fake persona. This isn't like a thing that I'm trying to work up. Like, these pillars, I was really intentional in choosing words and sentiments that really fit with the heart of what I want to do as my best self. And so for me, a lot of these pillars kind of developed based on what was kind of already happening in my content. You know, with visionary, like, obviously I was doing a lot of like wacky stuff that I didn't even imagine I'd get to do, let alone like another woman who looks like me or like has a similar background as me would even think that she would be able to do. Like, for the community, for me, it's really important. I love interviewing my artist peers and like having conversations, and I truly want to abolish gatekeeping so bad. Like, I really do not, I cannot stand gatekeeping. And every person who has ever gatekept me is probably kind of like, dang, like, well, like, because I remember how they treated me. And then now I'm like, oh, now I have some consequence, right? And obviously, I would never do anything out of spite. But it's like, how you treat people matters. That intern, how you treat them really matters.
100%. Wait, I just want to go back for a second for the community aspect, because I do think that you really do live this. And one of the ways for everyone listening, so they know, it's like, it's interesting because artists, of course, you know, historically have like created, but also very much wanted to protect their art, right? And you want to be paid for your art, and you should be paid for your art. But one of the things you did with Roe v. Wade specifically is you created a piece of artwork that you literally put on your website for people to download and use. And that, to me, speaks to this community pillar more than anything. It's like, take my art and express yourself with my art and use it.
There's a time and there's a place for everything. I will always champion artists making sure that they are not being taken advantage of.
Absolutely.
But I will also always use my artwork. Like, if my artwork can be a tool for something that's bigger than my rent, bigger than whatever, and if I'm in the position to do that, then I will always put my artwork out there. I kind of like feel the same way about my piece Justice, where anytime I've ever kind of put justice or sold justice, it always went to charity in some capacity. There are just certain artworks or there are certain initiatives that I do. I give out a lot of free advice to creatives. Like, I only just now really started being like, okay, like maybe people can like pay me for an hour of my time. But like, I create all of these talking head videos where it's like, hey, artists, like, let's talk about this. Hey, creatives, let's talk about that. Because there are so many other people, contemporaries or whatever, people who are in my position who are so protective over their status and so insecure about their station that they are not willing to have those conversations or to share information because they feel like it's going to impact their business. So with these pillars, I don't necessarily keep, well, I think when I do keep track, it's more so in terms of the clients that I work with now, because I used to say yes to everything. And now I'm kind of like, no, like I really want to think about if I'm going to be collaborating with Target. I don't know. I'm just making something up. I haven't collaborated with Target yet, but if I'm going to collaborate with Target, I really want to think about like, how can I create a collaboration with this brand that fits into my North Stars and like what I want to do? I don't just want to, like, for example, like a lot of brands come to Black Artists for Juneteenth and for Black History Month. And sometimes a lot of those campaigns are not as well thought out as they could be, or they're not exploring anything new, or they lean on stereotypes and lazy tropes of like, okay, like a Black hand, like breaking out of shackles and like things like though that imagery that is not future oriented is not representative of where we are in the present. And it's just very much so stuck in the past that it's not really serving anyone. And so for me, I'm just like, okay, well, like when I do Black History Month collaborations, how do I take it to the next level? How do I take what I create with this brand and turn it into a contemporary conversation or create contemporary benefit for progress, whether it's through investing in small Black businesses or donating to like a mental health fund, like the Loveland Foundation is one that I often fall back on. And so that's how I do my work. That's how I conduct my business. And even now, I don't even wait for brands to come to me anymore. Now I realize like I have a producer inside of me, right? So now I actually have developed and pulled together a team of people because I'm kind of anti-artist representation simply because like I have been ripped off by artist reps. And one thing that I decided is, oh, I need to build a team around me instead of like being chosen by an agency. So I've built my team. I have like a couple of ladies who like help me. And so we all meet, we all get together. And so now we sit down and we like think about who are the people we want to reach out to? How do we want to reach out? Let's create a pitch. Let's create a conversation. And we're really intentional about how we move. And like, that's kind of what I always needed. And it's something that really helps keep me in check because now I have these other people who believe in the Lo-Harris universe, who understand the Lo-Harris universe and want to keep it going.
It's so great. And I did see an interview where you were like, I don't want to just wait for a brand to call me. And that's exactly what you're sort of working against in the sense of saying like, you are creating your own universe and you are thinking about what you want to accomplish, which is amazing. So obviously you have now created a ton of artwork and you have to obviously create an environment for yourself to channel all of this. What do you do? Like, I would imagine you have to like put on and off your creative hat or you would burn out. So how do you get yourself ready to be creative and how do you also decompress from the energy that goes into doing that?
So glad you asked that. So I recently changed therapists. And I changed therapists because I was ready to work with a therapist who is used to working with creative types, because I realized that there was Lauren and there was Lo. Like Lo got to like wear her fabulous wigs and do all these interviews and go to these events and have a good time and be joyful. But sometimes it would happen at the expense of Lauren, who would be at home with a stain on her shirt, filling out invoices, trying to like animate things, like trying to make things happen so that Lo can post about it. And I really felt like, whoa, am I having a Hannah Montana moment? Like, you know, I felt like it was like, whoa, like what's happening? You know, like I have these two personalities and one is kind of like the sad one that gets all the work done. And the other one's like the fun one who's like, you know, like the moneymaker gets to have a good time. And even like I could recognize how people treated me differently in those two forms. And so I was like, no, no, no. So one thing I'm committed to doing right now is finding ways to separate Lo and Lauren and then take some of Lo's fun and apply it to Lauren, because there are plenty of people who love Lauren. So for me, part of that process in kind of turning on and turning off that creative light bulb over my head is developing a sense of routine and schedule. So one thing that I started doing is I have a weekly to-do list from 9 or like 10 to 5, which is loose, but each day of the week is dedicated to a different aspect of my business. So on Mondays, those are administrative days. That's when I'm sending invoices. That's when I'm communicating with my team. That's when I'm just doing all the paperwork and dirty work that has to happen for me to progress in the week. Tuesdays are for personal branding. So maybe that's a day where I'm kind of thinking about what clients do I want to talk to? How does this align with like the Lo-Harris brand? How do I take some of the content I already have and put it on other platforms to create more of a footprint? The third day is for clients, which if I have an existing client project, that's a day that I can kind of dedicate to thinking about nothing but getting that project done. The Thursday is for social media. So that's a day when I will put on clothes and I will sit in front of my microphone and I will just talk and create a bunch of talking head content. And then Fridays is for production. So if I have something I need to edit, or if I want to work on a client project, or if I want to do my paint marker videos, that's a day for me to, you know, have fun and just get stuff done and produce things. And then Saturdays and Sundays are for Lauren. So for me, it was really important to kind of have a setup like that, because it kind of allowed me permission to save things for another day. Because I realized one of my problems is that I have so many ideas in my head. Like, I want to expand into a lifestyle brand. Eventually, I want to do like candles and team up with my aunt to make handmade candles and do all these things that can live within the Lo Harris universe and be sold under that Lo Harris brand. But that's not stuff that I can do overnight. And I kind of like this sort of setup because it kind of allows me to say, like, okay, if I didn't finish something this week, like, that's a problem for Monday. You know what I mean? Or if I didn't send an invoice on Monday, you know, that's a problem for next Monday. Or if there's something production wise I didn't do, that's for next week. And it just allows me to kind of like, instead of letting all of the weight of the world stack up on my shoulders, it allows me to at least put organizer boxes where I can kind of say, like, all right, like, I have leftover stuff. This goes into the next week. You know what I mean? And this is when I'll address it. And so that I can enjoy my weekend.
I love this. And I'm going to steal this.
Oh my God. It's so good.
It's so good. Okay. Let's talk about your Be Kind box. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was definitely in the era of everybody was in my DMs and I was still working a full-time job. But yeah, they like reached out via Instagram, the Ellen team. And then like they actually reached out, two separate producers reached out, one for the Be Kind box and one to do a hoodie. And the Be Kind box happened, the hoodie happened.
So cool.
I was like really nervous. I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, but it ended up working out fine. And I had to record a video of myself to like go on air. And so like, I was like sitting on the couch with my then roommates and we were like, wow, I was just on the Ellen show. And it was just like, whoa, that's so cool. And that's kind of one of those pinch me projects where I was like, oh, I can't believe that happened. Like what?
And obviously you have more children's books coming.
Yeah. So children's books, that's a fun one for me. So I mentioned before that I was in like a really bad agent situation, which, you know, I was headhunted by an agency based in the UK who their commission rate was super high, but I didn't know, like, you know what I mean? Like they were going to take 35% out off the top of the stuff that I did with them. And they had certain clauses in there where it was like, you know, if you make royalties off a project, then we get 35% of those royalties too.
Wow.
And the frustrating thing about them is they did not get me any good work. Like a lot of the work that I was getting came strictly through my own social media.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, with one of my children's books, and I love the editors I work with, but unfortunately they thought they were doing the right thing. But because I was contractually obligated to put represented by this company in my bio as editors, they're thinking, well, instead of reaching out to her directly, we'll just go to her editors. But unfortunately, financially, that implied that they got me that job and they were entitled to 35% of it. So unfortunately, even though I was found through my own merit, through my own work, and that they really didn't do anything for me, they now get 35% chunk of those two children's books that I've done so far, which kind of makes promoting them bittersweet, but I'm still going to do it. But I learned from that experience, and I actually now have another children's books in the works with the same editors, and it's going to be about a little girl with a gap tooth and her aunt, who also has a gap tooth. So I'm super excited. It will also be my first time also authoring. So it's going to be a double whammy, completely Lo Harris production, complete creative control. So I'm super excited. And I'm going to consider that my first children's book.
I love it.
The other two, great. Like, you know what I mean? Like the author of Mama's Home, Shea Youngblood, wonderful writer. Really happy to see that one coming out. The second book's going to come out in October. The illustrations are so beautiful and there's so much love in them. It was such a cool project, but the next one is going to be definitely 100% on my own terms. And I love my editors. So I'm super excited to really continue into children's book world because I think that there's like a real home for me there. And like, it's nice to have like a children's book a year to work on and to kind of tell stories that I wish I had. And, you know, one of the ideas that I even have for this coming children's book is like, you know, I feel like a lot of books about little Black girls are always like, it's okay, like making them feel like it's okay to exist, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But this book, this little girl is already confident. So like, we don't need to have a whole journey about how she gets confident. She's already like, I love my gap and here's why. You know, instead of being so like, like, is it cute, auntie? And auntie has to guide her, like, no. So I'm super excited for that.
That's amazing. Lo, you've been on, I feel like, a whirlwind tour in a way. It's like your whole world is just bubbling up. It's so amazing. I mean, I always end the show the same way. So how do you ultimately want to leave your mark? What does Lo Harris universe look like 5 years from now?
5 years from now, I would love to be heading up a creative community or artist incubator. You know, one thing that I noticed is that there are a lot of great artists out there, but I think that they struggle to get the support they need to really tell their story holistically because they don't have teams. And so a lot of artists have really great work, but maybe they don't know how to present it in a way that builds a greater story and builds more brand equity for themselves. So my dream, like if I had like a bunch of funding, would be to get like a cohort of 3 or 4 artists that I believe in and invest in getting them websites made, invest in getting them headshots done, and getting them a social strategist or some sort of admin assistant, and getting them through some workshops on how they can like work with commercial clients, how to deal with particular things, how to network. I really love the idea of like building a creative community, and I'm really invested in, again, I want to abolish gatekeeping. I feel like it would be so awesome to have some sort of artist community that shares information and has like full transparency on the highest performing level. Cause I think there are a lot of those communities where people are sharing their prices, but they're very much in like a different time in their career or a different kind of career. But I feel like there's like a lot of money to be made and like a lot of wealth to be created for BIPOC creatives, like in advertising, in media, in all of these different ways. And so I feel like I want to be known and remembered as a mentor and as an elder instead of as somebody who made a young person or an up and coming person feel like they were in the way or annoying or needed to be humble. I'm not here for that. So that's one way that I want to leave my mark. And then otherwise, you know, I love the idea of a scholarship fund. I love the idea of a lifestyle brand. I really want to start selling like hats and shirts and like candles and body essentials and things that really, because I have a lot of good taste, you know what I mean? Like I know how to draw, but I'm not a crafts person, but I'm a shopper. I'm a major shopper. So if I can find a way to create a brand under my values of authenticity, visionary, community, education, kindness, vibrance, confidence, joy, and have all a marketplace under that roof, like I'm happy with that.
Oh, you will do it. You will do it. I can't wait to see it all happen. It's amazing. Well, listen, Lo, this was great. I am so happy for every success you have. You're so super talented. And like I said in the beginning of the show, if you've not checked out Lo Harris's art, you should, because it will make you smile. And I just wish you all the best of luck. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Take care, y'all.
Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.